The government's a bit like somebody who wants to lose weight. They set a target a year from now, I want to get down to my target weight, and then they decide that tomorrow they're going to go on a diet. And then tomorrow they're going to go on a diet. And then each week they...
That's how I diet.
Yeah. It's a common way of dieting, but it's not a successful way of dieting.
And I can also concur.
And what we're finding is the government's finding that week on week it's actually putting on weight, but because the target goal is a year away, they go, oh, don't worry about it. When I get there, I got plenty of time left.
She'll be right.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute.
I'm Frank Bainimarama, the president of COP23. Welcome to COP23.
International climate negotiations is probably the most complicated piece of international negotiations right now.
Thank you for your sustained efforts to secure a positive outcome to the negotiations here in Cancun.
We come here in Copenhagen because climate change poses a grave and growing danger.
It's that time of year again where governments around the world descend on a city like a massive climate circus for the annual United Nations climate change talks. Thousands of government officials, scientists, green groups, tech companies, business, fossil fuel and industry lobbyists, and even climate change deniers like Lord Monckton fly into these cities every year just before Christmas to wrangle over the global legal document that commits countries to tackle global warming. It's how cities like Kyoto, Copenhagen, and Paris have become synonymous with global climate agreements. And today we're talking about how Australia fares when it comes to meeting its climate commitment under these agreements, with the Australia Institute's senior economist Matt Grudnoff and director of our climate and energy program, Richie Merzian. So this year, the climate caravan is heading to the Polish city of Katowice.
Can you just explain what is exactly a COP meeting, a conference of the parties?
It's a good question. So a COP is United Nations shorthand for the annual meeting of all the parties, so all the countries who are signed up to the Convention on Climate Change, which was signed back in the early 90s. And every year, all the countries get together to see how they can further implement their actions on climate change.
So the big meeting in Paris a couple of years back, that was a COP.
That's correct, yep.
And who's hosting this year's COP and what can we expect from it?
So this year, Poland is hosting it, and it usually rotates between the five regional groups in the UN. And Poland has hosted it twice before. This time it's hosting it in a coal town called Katowice near Krakow. And what we can expect at this one is what the UN climate chief calls Paris 2.0. So this conference will try and bed down the rules for how we implement the Paris Agreement that was agreed and signed by now 195 countries.
Just for a quick recap, at Paris, countries broadly agreed to keep global temperatures from increasing by more than 2 degrees of warming. To help meet this goal, Australia promised to cut its own domestic emissions by 26 to 28% from the amount of gases being pumped out in 2005. Now, climate scientists say 2 degrees of warming is too dangerous for some low-lying countries to survive, and that a safer target for the planet would be 1.5 degrees rise in global temperatures.
Well, what the IPCC report has done is found that there's a lot of climate damages already by the time we get to 1.5 degrees. These include major risks to coral reefs, and maybe 70 to 90% actually being lost at that warming level. Significant increases in drought, damages to agricultural production, increased heat waves. Prior to this report, it was fairly obvious that there were some differences to 2 degrees, but now this report's confirmed absolutely that the damages are increasing very rapidly. An extra 0.5 degree of warming will exacerbate all of these problems.
The Australian Labor Party has just announced a raft of new energy policies as part of its climate strategy, where it pledges to go further than the government and commit to a 45% target on those 2005 levels.
and invest in cleaner, cheaper power to help achieve 50% renewables by 2030, to build the national energy infrastructure of the future, the pipelines, the pumped hydro, the interconnectors and the storage, and household battery technology for homeowners and renters alike.
If Australia is serious about meeting its Paris carbon reduction commitments, then 70% of our electricity will need to come from renewables by 2030.
Australia is committed to that historic global compact we struck in Paris.
Let's not forget Australia accounts for just over 1% of global emissions, so there are a lot bigger players than us out there.
But not only is Australia not doing its fair share of global efforts to clean up this mess, Australia isn't even on track to meet its own 26 to 28% target. In fact, Australia's emissions are growing.
So Australia put forward what it calls a middle of the pack target, which is to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% by 2030, and that's from a 2005 emissions baseline. And we are not on track to hit that target. In fact, Australia is going the opposite direction. So when you hear the Prime Minister say that we are going to meet it in a canter, we are not.
He's telling burpees.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt, is our 26 to 28% target, is that middle of the pack? Is that adequate?
Well, it's not adequate. So it's not enough for our fair share to reach 2 degrees. And we saw a report just recently that showed that even 1.5 degrees of warming was going to cause serious problems, and that's what we should be aiming at, not 2 degrees. So the idea of the target was to try and get all the countries on board, but the expectation was is that countries would do more, that is, they would increase their target as we got closer and closer to 2030. So not only is Australia's emissions rising at the moment, they've risen every year for the last 3 years, and particularly they've risen since we got rid of the carbon price. Not only not surprisingly, but this 26 to 28% target is like the bare minimum. We should be aiming for an even higher target. And so we're not even going to meet the bare minimum.
So we're not even going to meet the bare minimum, but why are our emissions rising?
Well, they're rising for a number of reasons. The most obvious one is we don't really have any policies to reduce our emissions. When we had a carbon price, our emissions fell because we had an actual policy that was designed to reduce our emissions. At the moment, the government has a few small policies that are making very small amounts of reduction, and that's not enough to cause our emissions to actually fall. In fact, if we look forward, the government's own department, the Department of Environment, has predicted out to 2030, what's going to happen to our emissions given the current policies the government has. And it shows, the government's own figures show, that by 2030 we will produce 888 million tonnes of emissions over the target, and in 2030 alone we will have 128 million tonnes of emissions over the target. So the government's own figures show we're going to miss our Paris target.
To the Paris Conference of the Parties, very credible and substantial emissions targets, cuts in targets. Our cuts of 26 to 28% reduction from 2005 are very substantial.
I just have a bugbear around this 26 to 28% because the 28% isn't, we're never going to take that up as an option.
Yeah.
The 28% was a condition that Abbott put in that if all the other countries or comparative economies were going to do more, then Australia would do more. So really, it was never intended by the current government that we would ever go to 28%. It was just to make us sound a little bit better. So the government's only doing 26%, and even then, it's trying to do the bare minimum within the economies, within the sectors that need a transition. So when we were talking about the National Energy Guarantee, it only wanted to apply a 26% target on that. And for the sector of our economy that is the most polluting, it should be doing the most in terms of the heavy lifting to reduce our emissions, especially because it's quite cheap to do so compared to other sectors.
Australian Prime Ministers have a habit of claiming that Australia will meet its targets.
People say a lot about Kyoto. We didn't sign Kyoto for the very good reason it was not in our interest to do so. But we are going to meet the target that Australia was given under the Kyoto arrangement, unlike many of the countries that are allegedly bound by the protocol.
For years, former Prime Minister John Howard refused to sign into law the International Kyoto Treaty, the first global agreement to reduce emissions. But he would often boast that he didn't need to because Australia was already meeting its Kyoto target. As Matt explains, most of this was met by Australia getting a special clause to include stopping land clearing by Queensland farmers.
So one of the main arguments the government uses is that we have two Kyoto targets, Kyoto 1 and Kyoto 2, and we met Kyoto 1 and we're on target to meet Kyoto 2 in 2020. Now, when they say we met the targets, Kyoto 1 wasn't a reduction target. Kyoto 1 was actually, we had to limit the increase in our emissions to 8%, so we could allow our emissions to go up by 8%. So the government doesn't have form on reducing emissions from Kyoto 1. They just didn't have them rise above 8%.
And they were the only country that got this
That's
leeway
right.
to increase emissions.
They got a special deal so that they could increase their emissions while everybody else had to reduce it. So they met Kyoto 1 by increasing their emissions. Mm. Kyoto 2 came along, and that was actually a 5% reduction on 2000 levels. Again, what they did was, is because they met Kyoto 1, they used some rollover credits, basically an accounting trick, in order and applied those to their Kyoto 2 target. So if you look at our actual emissions since 2000, they're flat. But we're going to meet the 5% reduction target by taking these accounting tricks and applying them, and that gets us from a 0% reduction to a 5% reduction. So Kyoto 1 and Kyoto 2 do not provide evidence that our government knows how to reduce emissions. It only supplies evidence that the Howard government and now the Morrison government know how to use the accounting tricks in order to look like we're meeting our targets. The problem for Australia is that the Paris targets doesn't have any of this accounting trick, correct? And so we have to actually reduce our emissions. And the government can't rely on rollover credits and accounting and pretending that they're reducing their emissions when they're actually going up.
So if emissions are increasing, what policies or tools could a country use to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions? Well, economists largely agree that a carbon tax or a carbon price would be a pretty good start.
There will be no carbon tax under the government I lead.
There's no stopping it now. Australia will have a tax on carbon in just over 7 months.
Today, Australia has a price on carbon as the law of our land.
What the housewives of Australia need to understand, their own power bills, when they switch the iron on, are going to go up.
A great big new tax that, just for starters, will drive your power bill up by $300.
The fact is that everyone in the energy sector, every economist knows, so what you need effectively is a price on carbon.
It's been a while now since we've had the carbon price. Just quickly, as an economist, Matt, can you explain how that worked to push down emissions?
Yeah, so what a carbon price does is it makes firms think about how they're going to produce their goods. So they pay a tax or a price per tonne of carbon they produce. And like all good businesses, they look at their costs and they think, well, how can I reduce them? Because if I can reduce my costs, I can increase my profits. And so when they're looking around at trying to reduce their costs, they see this line item of the carbon price and they think, well, how can I make that lower? So they go about and they work out ways to produce the same amount of stuff, but with less carbon emissions. And they're rewarded in doing that, in that they pay less tax. And so because you force firms all over Australia to do that, firms are looking around, they innovate, they come up with new ways to produce that reduce emissions. And we know it's effective. Not only did it work in Australia in the 2 years that we had a carbon price, but it's also worked in countries all over the world. So it's a proven, effective method for reducing emissions, and we decided to scrap it.
So we scrap the carbon price, Richie. What do we have left that's trying to reduce emissions in terms of policy?
Very little. We have the legacy items from the previous government. So the renewable energy target, the large-scale renewable energy target, runs until the end of this decade.
And which the government has tried to water down.
And actually has succeeded in watering down. So that'll mean that we'll get to 23% renewable energy in our grid, and that's sort of on the East Coast, and that has helped put pressure down on electricity prices, and it's also managed to reduce emissions in the electricity sector, which is our largest polluting sector. Apart from that, there's very little. There's some work in energy efficiency, there's nothing in transport, there's a little bit in terms of a safeguards mechanism that the government has, but even that we've found is ineffective. And a great example of how ineffective that is over in WA, Chevron has one of the largest gas plants called the Gorgon Gas Plant. And as part of the development approval, it promised to sequester or bury 80% of the emissions from the production of gas there. And that was supposed to take place in 2016. It hasn't. So for the last 2 years, instead of burying the emissions, they've been just going up into the atmosphere, and they're responsible for an equivalent amount of half of the increase in our national emissions year on year. Wow. They're that big. And instead of punishing Chevron for not following through on its application to sequester it, the government has just allowed them to revise their baseline to factor in failure so that they get away scot-free. And that's what the safeguards mechanism does. It's entirely ironic in name.
So it's not really safeguarding us from anything. It's just rampant pollution.
Well, I think
it's safeguarding the company from having to pay for its emissions.
Exactly. And this is a company that already gets away with a very low tax bill.
So, Matt, if that's the case and Australia's emissions are rising, at what point, you know, how are we going to tackle our emissions in the future, do you think?
Well, it's a really good question. You can't reach a 26% reduction target if emissions keep going up year on year.
I'm no scientist, but that does seem obvious to me.
Yeah, I mean, the maths for most people, they would understand. And the government seems a bit bewildered by this. The government's a bit like somebody who wants to lose weight, right? They set a target a year from now, I want to get down to my target weight. And then they decide that tomorrow they're going to go on a diet. And then tomorrow they're going to go on a diet. And then each week they...
That's how I diet.
Yeah. It's a common way of dieting, but it's not a successful way of dieting.
And I can also concur.
And what we're finding is the government's finding that week on week it's actually putting on weight, but because the target goal is a year away, they go, oh, don't worry about it. When I get there, I got plenty of time left.
She'll be right.
And that's exactly what the government's doing. They have no policies to reduce emissions. Our emissions are going up, not down. And they're telling us that, oh, we're on target. They're deluding themselves, and they're trying to delude the Australian public that everything's fine. And clearly it's not.
There's no room for partisan politics when the reliability, affordability and sustainability of Australia's energy system is at stake.
What we desperately need in our electricity system is more reliability. And let's face it, a lot of that is coal, gas.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows the rule on crops.
It's coal that has ensured for over 100 years
the Deputy
that Australia
Prime Minister
has enjoyed an energy competitive advantage.
In Australia, while there has been negligent inaction on climate change, the government has succeeded in shifting the debate away from the dangers of global warming and onto energy security and energy prices. In other words, they argue we need coal to keep the lights on. We have both a Prime Minister and a new Minister for Energy, Angus Taylor, talking about building new coal-fired power stations when the IPCC and the International Energy Agency warn that coal should be phased out. And the population agrees. The Australia Institute's Climate of the Nation survey found that 70% of the public want the orderly phase-out of coal and for it to be replaced with clean energy.
What do you want?
We know that people right around the world today are joining together to say no more new coal.
The report finds we basically need to be out of coal by 2050. In other words, no more coal used for power production globally by 2050.
From what I understand, the government is looking at underwriting new coal-fired power as part of its new energy policy and potentially also covering liability for any future carbon risk. Can you explain a little bit about what's happening there?
Yeah, that's right. So Minister Taylor, our Minister for getting electricity prices down,
but not doing anything about emissions.
And renewable energy, which is getting the prices down. Minister Taylor is chomping at the bit to try and get new coal-fired power generation or refurbished, so extended lives, on the old, you know, clunky coal-fired power stations. That is his mission under his particular portfolio. And he's doing that by offering taxpayer subsidies for new coal power or for these continued coal power stations to kick on. And he's rushing ahead without even agreeing on what the program's going to look like, is already taking expressions of interest, and we question whether it even has the legislative authority to do this. So the real issue here is that you have a minister who, instead of actually looking at how you bring down prices, or instead of looking at how you take the electricity sector forward, recognizing that there's a lot of new generation coming online from renewable energy, is just sticking to one particular type of technology. He says it's technology neutral, his approach, but he's said at other times that it will include coal and gas. So he's looking to try and fund, through public money, coal-fired power stations. And that's the only way that you can proceed.
Why is that? If it was such a great idea, business would be right in there.
You'd think they would, but it's not such a great idea. So almost every piece of new power that's come online has come from large-scale solar or wind. And what you're seeing going forward is that a continuation of that, with additional firming power coming in. So that's pumped hydro, that's solar thermal.
So for people who don't know, what is firming power? That's a term people might not be familiar with.
So firming power is just basically power that can be turned on and off very, very quickly. So if you want, you know, if you turn your light switch on, you want power definitely then. So it's power when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, as all the climate skeptics say. But firming power, interestingly, is not coal power. Why is it not coal power? Because coal power actually takes a long time to wind up, and it takes a long time to slow down. And it's very inefficient to make a coal-fired power station increase and decrease its output. It's very good at sitting there 24 hours a day pumping out power. But that's not firmed power, that's baseload power.
Yeah.
And what firmed power means is that if there's an increase in demand for power one evening, one still evening...
Say it's really hot and everyone puts on their air conditioner.
That's right. How do we turn the power and force power into the grid quickly? Coal can't do that. Pumped hydro can do that. Battery storage can do that. To a certain extent, gas peaking plants, some gas can do that. And solar thermal can do that, but coal can't.
And Matt, as an economist, this idea of taking on the liability for future carbon risks, is that a good idea?
Well, it's a dangerous idea for taxpayers. And the reason is effectively the electricity sector is going through a transformation, not just in Australia, but all over the world. Renewable energy is becoming cheaper and cheaper. And so therefore, we're changing over. It used to be that coal and gas were the cheapest forms of power. Decades ago, that was the case. It's not the case now. And so what we're seeing is a shift from one form of power to the next. And what the government is effectively doing is it has bought Blockbuster Video and it is underwriting it with taxpayer dollars in order to keep it open. But the point is, we're moving on. Technology has changed. Exactly right. And so what's going to happen? Well, we're going to have this enormous clunker that will cost taxpayers a fortune and is not meeting the needs for our future electricity market. And so it's a vanity project for the government, and it's going to be an expensive one.
And that's true globally too, isn't it, Richie? Was it the IEA that said basically coal has to come to an end before 2050?
Yeah, so the IEA, which is not a traditional lefty institution, but quite a conservative club in Paris, they've just put out their World Energy Outlook for 2018 a couple of days ago. And in it, they've mapped out a few different scenarios. But the scenario that's going to keep us under 2 degrees, which is the goal of Paris and the goal that every country has signed up to, is that coal needs to be wound down. And if you look at the IPCC report, it says it needs to be all but gone by 2050. So if we are going into a future where we don't want to be stuck with another blockbuster, but really we wanted to be buying into what is the next wave of entertainment, then that's going to be in renewables. And just a shout out for Fenty and Power and Mike Cannon Brooks and the movement that's taking place right now. It's about transitioning Australia, not just so that we are domestically secure in terms of our energy supply, but that we are rethinking how we operate as an energy exporter. And there's some really awesome technologies and ideas around how we can do that, but we're not going to get there if we keep funding technology from the past.
That's been episode 30 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded on the 16th of November 2018 in Canberra with Matt Grudnoff and Richie Merzian. You can visit our website at tai.org.au for the Climate of the Nation survey. And you can also read more analysis on Australia's Paris climate commitment and the need to be a good global citizen, as well as other energy and climate related reports on our website. You can listen free to Follow the Money wherever you download your favourite podcasts, and you can find previous episodes online. We often cover energy and climate change debates, and you can check out episode 14 of our summer special with former president of Kiribati, Anote Tong. Stay tuned, we'll be releasing more specials for those long road trips over summer as part of our summer special series recorded at our popular Politics in the Pub sessions. This summer, we will also continue to monitor which gas and coal plants can't handle the heat as part of our Gas and Coal Watch project, where you can follow along too on our website and on our Twitter handle, and we'll be posting updates on social media all throughout summer. You can follow us on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Matt Grudnoff is at Matt Grudnoff with a double T in Matt and a double F in Grudnoff. And Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian, Merzian. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with additional editing by Lizzie Jack. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.